Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Hope you're well. Got another thought experiment for you that hopefully will be educational and at the very least kind of get the creative juices flowing here. And you'll notice the title most likely didn't make sense to a lot of you. Is it possible to have consumer price deflation without money printing? So let me be clear as to what I'm talking about. First of all, when I say deflation, I'm talking about the prices of things going down in a healthy manner, not due to a deflationary bust or a credit bust, something like that, not due to deflationary money, which is the money supply going down, but actually due to creating more goods and services, what I would call healthy deflation. And how do you tell if deflation is healthy or unhealthy? Well, it's actually pretty simple. Just ask yourself, does it increase demand? So if we had deflation today in the United States, that would be no bueno because it would decrease demand because it's not healthy deflation. It would be a credit bust or an asset bust. So same thing, but the opposite side of the coin there is if you look at the 1800s and we had significant deflation, but through the most of the century there, that was because we were producing more stuff. Let's call it the Industrial Revolution. And therefore, this increased demand. It didn't decrease demand. And so that would be what I would consider good deflation. So can we have good deflation without money printing? And here, I'm using the term money printing for an expansion of the money supply, or what Snyder would say, elasticity in the money supply, which ironically people get confused. They think that's just a one-way street, but elasticity doesn't necessarily mean that it's expanding, but it also means that it can contract. It's fluid to a degree, right? So this is very counterintuitive and may sound like a provocative statement if you're one of these, like I am, like one of these macro geeks, but let's think this through here. I just posed a question to Josh before we hit the live button. And I said, give me a time in history when we have had healthy, positive, desirable deflation without an increase in the money supply. And you may be able to say, okay, George, well, let's go back 2000 years and we had a big economic boom in XYZ place where prices went down and we're on a gold standard, so money was relatively fixed. Right, but let's remember that even back thousands of years ago, when they were circulating gold, let's say coins, that was not the only form of payment. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. We had something called credit. And credit did and could and did expand the quote-unquote money supply or the purchasing power, which allows businesses to become more productive and therefore create more goods and services. And once you get the goods and services increasing, then you can go ahead or increasing faster than the money supply, then consumer prices will most likely come down. Or this comes down with technology, if you want to look at it that way, right? So, but my point here is it just doesn't mean that because we have consumer price deflation, healthy deflation, that this means that the money supply is stable, the money supply is going down. Absolutely not. And again, just to be super, super clear here, I think there's a strong argument for saying that we might not even be able to have deflation, healthy deflation, without an expansion of the money supply or elasticity in the money supply, because there wouldn't be the sufficient capital to create enough goods and services to push prices down in aggregate total. Let me show you what I mean here. Let's go over to the Visual Capitalist, which I think is a fantastic website. History of consumer credit. And, you know, the Austrians, and I've made fun of the gold bugs today, made fun of the Bitcoiners. Now I'll make fun of the Austrians. Pretty much every single person who is a subscriber to the George Gammon channel, I'm going to go ahead and piss off today, which hopefully shows you that my priorities are not subscribers or pandering to an audience, but they're actually to get to the truth and to encourage you to think, even if sometimes that pisses you off. Hopefully you can appreciate that. But getting back to this article, the history of consumer credit all in one giant infographic. So my point there, Austrians, they always think, oh my gosh, this credit creation, this is evil. This is a result of the government. And obviously I'm no fan of the government, that's for sure. But this is them talking. And they say, oh, well, if we wouldn't have this credit creation or expansion of the money supply, blah, 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 then this is kind of the root problem here. And this is the devil. And it's all creation of central planning and governments. And basically, they kind of view this as credit creation started like after the Federal Reserve somehow. Or even consumer credit. But no, that's not true. That's not true. Check this out. This graphic is super cool. The history of not just credit, consumer credit. It says today, credit is everywhere. Credit may seem like a modern invention, but it's actually been around for 5,000 years. We go back to 3500 BC, Sumer. I think this is where we get Sumerians. You guys can probably help me out with that one. Sumerian Empire. I think that was what it was called. But anyway, Sumer is the first urban civilization with about 89% of its population living in cities. Back then, yeah, I remember seeing a documentary on this, and this was actually just like a novel concept. It is thought that consumer loans, because before they were just kind of like following buffalo around or whatever the heck they followed in this part of the following camels around or, you know, just kind of like hunter-gatherer types. It is thought that, but even in 3500 BC, it is thought that consumer loans for agricultural purposes are first used here. So they had consumer loans to buy food or maybe to grow food. Then we move on to 1800 BC in Babylon. The Code of Hammurabi is written formalizing the first known laws around credit. They established max interest rates, and FYI, the max interest rate on loans of grain was 33.3%, on loans of silver, 20%. So again, you could say, well, George, this isn't increasing the money supply. How is an expansion of credit not increasing the money supply? And even if you say, well, they were taking their physical silver coins and giving those silver coins to someone else, and therefore that wasn't expansionary, although it was a form of credit. And I would argue, okay, but if we go back and then look at other history, we see that even going back probably this far, at least to the Roman Empire for sure, they had ledger money. They had ledger money because it was inconvenient for silver to go back and forth, back and forth. So they just kept track of it saying, okay, well, I owe you this much, then this many pieces of silver, and the silver actually wouldn't transact. That's effectively money printing. Roman Empire, 50 BC. Around this time, Cicero notes that his neighbor bought 625 acres of land for 11.5 million sesterces. Oh, wow. Check this out. No, that was done through credit and paper. So they said, did they literally carry 1.5 tons of coins through the streets of Rome? No, it was done through credit and paper. Cicero writes, nomina facit negotium confiscit, or he uses credit to complete the purchases. Again, expansion of the money supply. Now, I could go on and on and on here. In fact, I'd strongly encourage you guys to check out this graphic. It's super cool. As you can see, it's visualcapitalist.com. And then it's history, consumer credit, one infographic. But we go down to the Dark Ages. Now they start talking about credit, and they start talking about usury and the defense of usury. Oh, I thought this was very interesting. Philosopher Jeremy Bentham writes a treatise called A Defense of Usury, arguing that restrictions on interest rates harm the ability to raise capital for innovation. If risky new ventures cannot be funded, then growth becomes limited. Oh, maybe that title of this video isn't so crazy after all. And again, maybe, in order to get to produce enough goods and services to create consumer price deflation, maybe, just maybe, you have to have an expansion of the money supply via credit and not just trading this gold coin and giving or taking this gold coin and giving it to someone else. But you physically have this gold coin and you are extending them. They're getting a credit. So you're saying, okay, I'll sell you this. I'll give you this machinery and you don't have to give me any gold coins. You can just agree to pay me gold coins back in the future. Therefore, that would basically be like increasing the purchasing power of the overall system. Hey guys, I want to remind you to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. This is the incredible online investment forum that I have with investment experts, Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It includes professionals such as Patrick Serezna from Macro Voices. He specializes in options. Tony Greer, commodity trading. Jason Hartman, real estate. And Brent Johnson with macroeconomics. If you want to build wealth and thrive in this world of out-of-control central banks and big governments, Rebel Capitalist Pro is the resource you need. So check it out today at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. We'll see you inside with the fellow rebel capitalists that are taking their investing to the next level. Then we go through modern consumer credit. And this is more about what people envision credit. Here we had the first reporting system in England, like your credit score, basically, 1803. And then we go through kind of organizing the credit for specific business entities. And then you had the consumer credit boom. And this is pretty much where most of us kind of think of the expansion of credit or consumer credit once we had the Federal Reserve. But I want to be very, very clear. I'm not saying that I'm a proponent of fiat money, or I'm not a proponent of the gold standard or sound money or anything like that. I definitely am. But I also try to think through these things very carefully. And maybe I'll change my mind, or maybe I'll even come to some conclusions, because I don't think I've yet come to some definitive conclusions. But as of right now, I don't, when you're looking at the costs and the benefits, I don't know the benefits outweigh the costs by having a fixed money supply. And I think all of the benefits you hear from a fixed money supply may be theoretical and maybe not realistic in practice.
George, you're forgetting. It's infinitely divisible. It's the all and be all.
Right. And it is, but it goes back to our little graph here, Josh, where let's go back to what this guy said in 1787, this Bentham fellow. And he said that if risky new ventures cannot be funded, then growth becomes limited. So the argument there would be, okay, we've got to fix money supply and you're going to lend that out. You're just not going to create credit on, you're not going to create credit above and beyond. You're not going to lend out a paper claim on the money supply, if you will. So the only thing you're lending out is quote unquote money that is in existence right now. So if you're going to lend out a gold coin, you don't give them credit. You don't sell them something on credit. They have to, you could give them that gold coin and then they could give that gold coin to someone else, but there's still only one gold coin in circulation or one gold coin worth of purchasing power. That's probably the best way to think about it, in circulation. And you can see how you could have extreme consume, even without one gold coin in circulation, how you could have pretty significant consumer price inflation if everyone was extending credit to other people to buy the goods and services they were producing, right? But the pushback there from the full reserve camp is going to be, if there is sufficient demand, productive demand for loans, then what will happen is this, the interest rate will go up. This will encourage people to save. And then those savings will be distributed because the interest rate's gone up. But my point is, okay, but who's to say that the hurdle rate won't be so high that it will negatively impede productive growth, right? And the concern here is the boom-bust cycle. And I totally get it. But to sit there and say that if we have fractional reserve banking, as an example, that we're just going to always get this massive boom and bust cycle, that isn't necessarily true. Or I guess a better way to say this is the position that if we do have a slight boom and bust cycle, although with much higher growth, the net balance or the net result is going to be inferior to a system where we have far, far slower growth, but we reduce that boom and bust cycle. And I would there again, I would think through, I don't know that you're going to reduce that boom bust cycle, because if you can't expand the money supply, if things aren't centralized to a certain degree, not by government, but the private sector, then I don't know how you could go through an event like a flood or a natural disaster or something like that, or a recession, when the incentive is to hoard money and therefore not lend it out, you see, or not increase it, not take risk. There's all these factors that go into the equation. And I don't think it's as cut and dry as people would like to believe. And again, I don't know that the benefits that we're told of a full reserve system would actually come to fruition in practice. And they may, those benefits that are attached to full reserve may be seen to a greater degree in a fractional reserve system. That's pretty much what I'm trying to say here. And again, to be clear, fractional reserve does not mean you have a central bank. It does not mean that you have government involved. People associate those, and they're not the same. They're not synonymous. We have to remember that fractional reserve banking was a product of the free market. The free market invented fractional reserve banking. The government did not. And they invented it without the help of the government, because you could say, well, maybe the private sector invented it, but that's because the public sector was backstopping their balance sheet or bailing them out. No. It was almost exclusively a result of the free market. So guys, enjoy the rest of your afternoon. Hopefully that got you thinking. And as always, make sure that you're standing up for freedom, liberty, free market, capitalism. We'll see you in the next video.